So here we are, the last part in my 3-part conversation with the lovely Bob Harris. And dare I say it, I think this may have been my favourite part, simply because it was so lovely to hear Bob speak so candidly and so lovingly about his family and how close he is to his 8 children. And he mentioned how he feels surrounded by love, you know, through his wonderful friends, his family, and also through, you know, his fans that he has that follow him through Instagram and Twitter. And I suppose that's a reflection of him, really. Everything that he puts out there, you know, attracts love in return. So it was a wonderful thing to hear him speak about, you know, how that's an important part of his life, you know, putting the right message out there to the world. And he quoted this beautiful line from a Nat King Cole song, which has fond memories for me because of my father. And it was, "The greatest thing to ever learn is to be loved and to love in return." So he talked about finding his confidence again after the breakup of his marriage to Trudy, getting used to being on his own, you know, finding inner peace and living a wholesome life, which he clearly does now. And then we also talked about, you know, the importance of being kind and being a good role model. So he mentioned Danny Baker. I mean, they've got this incredible rapport. Anybody that was lucky enough to see them in their recent tour, which was huge and absolutely brilliant, would have picked up on this great rapport between the two of them, how they bounce off one another. And we spoke about the old grey whistle test and the peaks and troughs of his amazing career. And he touched on a great friend of his, Beth Nielsen Chapman, and how she has been a huge inspiration to him, her attitude and her courage through her own cancer diagnosis inspired him to be as courageous himself. I really genuinely hope that all the Bob fans out there will enjoy hearing this different side to him and, you know, just hearing the man behind the music, behind the show, and just how lovely he is. I didn't want this conversation to end, and I'm hoping one day we're going to revisit this all over again. So I just hope you all enjoy too. Right, so Bob, you've been married a couple of times, well, three times.
Yeah.
And that must have taught you a lot about many, many things, but tell me what you know about love.
Such a massive question.
It's a huge question.
Yeah, it is, actually. Well, from my own experience, just talking about my marriages, I have 8 children altogether, and I can truly say that we are close. Honestly, we are. Marsden and Flo have Trudy as their mum. Ben and Jamie have...
They're your youngest, aren't they?
Yes, they are.
Yeah.
So I'm going through the family probably in age order.
Yeah.
So then Ben and Jamie have Valentina as their mum. My daughter Charlie has Jackie as her mum. And then my first wife, Sue, and I have Miri and Emma's. And actually, it was Miri, my eldest daughter, Morel, that introduced you and I.
That's right,
wasn't it?
Yeah. She's so lovely.
She is.
She's quite a special woman, actually.
So we are close. We are all close, and we look after each other. We've got each other's back. We generally do. Flo was saying that Flo works at Big Machine, which is one of the, you know, it's a major, major label in America, with the huge artists on it, Thomas Rhett and Florida Georgia Line. And so Flo is now a woman in the middle of a very, very demanding music industry. Mm. She works in Soho. So she's surrounded by people at work who look at her with marvel at the fact that she and her dad, speak on the phone 3 or 4 times a day.
Aww.
They can't, well, I mean, they love that we're as close as we are.
Mm.
But they say, we don't have that relationship with our parents, that we're on the phone with them the whole time. But me and Flo, me and Dylan and Miles and Charlie, all of us, we're, Ben was here last week. I was down at Charlie's the weekend before. We're all together. And so to me, that thing when you know that somebody has got your back, you find it with friends too, don't you? I mean, I'm very, very, very lucky now, blessed to, there's a support network that's built up around me where we're all friends and we're all on an absolutely equal footing.
Yeah.
My friend I mentioned, David Granville from the Village, I couldn't run this place were it not for him.
Mm.
Mark Hagen, Al Booth, my brilliant manager, Nick Cannon. That was another thing around the time that the tour fell out with COVID. I was managerless because Trudy had been managing me. And of course, we're now not together. So I'm really, I think it was Helen Thomas, who called Nick to say, I know that Bob's looking for management. Would you think about taking him on? And Nick and I had a couple of conversations, and it became immediately clear to me that he cared. That was, you know, that was the really important aspect of it, that he said, come on, Bob, you know, I'm part of this process of yours of saying, come on, world, I'm going to take you on.
Yeah.
I'm going to make the best of everything. He said, I'm going to help you do that. And he has, you know, the fact that he and I can talk the way we do and that he gives me such confidence, which he does, you know, don't you worry, we'll get you sorted. There's and it's working. It's really, really working. All of which has been gradually filling me with confidence. And I know this is...
But do you miss being in love? Do you miss the feeling of having someone around?
Yeah, I guess...
Because to be with someone for such a long time.
I know. I think... I certainly did.
Yeah.
I think now, though, 2.5 years on, I've got used to it now. And I'm actually happy in my own company.
Yeah.
And feel...
You can see that. It's lovely.
And I feel like you do when you're by yourself. You're you. I'm more me now than I have been for a long time.
Yeah.
So everything is for a reason.
And
so this is... But that's... So love is what I see when I look in Minnie's eyes, for example. Or what's in the atmosphere of when I... I've posted something about my health, let's say, on Instagram, and I start scrolling down and looking
and
at the comments,
and the love surges towards
you. It's just unbelievable. And even that, you know, my Instagram account, I want it to stand for love, if you want to put it like that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I totally get that.
And it's the same with my radio programs. They're not just thrown together.
I know.
I mean, you know, I you can see my workstation here.
Fabulous.
Here we are in my studio. I think about every single track and its place in the show, and the track that's going to follow it, and what that track is saying, the stories of those songs, the lyrics, where they're taking us, all of that stuff, the flow through from the first track that I play through the program to the final track I play that night. All of this comes into view as I'm beginning
to put my programs through. Well, your love of
music
and your passion, that's it, all translates through everything you do.
Yes.
You know? So, love means many different things.
It does.
It presents itself in different ways.
But in its way, Isabel, that's, you know, I want the program to stand for that.
Of course.
Honestly, I do.
Yeah.
My dad was huge about this word of karma. The love, what you put out comes back to you. And I truly do believe that.
Yeah.
And certainly, growing up in the 60s, as you move into the mid-60s, and, you know, 1967, the summer of 67, and the Beatles are singing, All You Need Is Love.
Wow.
And I am one of those people going, yep. The greatest thing, that these are the lyrics of Nature Boy song, that was recorded by Nat King Cole.
That's one of my father's favourites.
And then covered later by Bobby Darin, which was sort of the first time I heard it. But Nature Boy, the greatest thing you will ever learn is just to love and be loved in return. Well, there we are. Strips they everything away.
Do you know, when simple. I listen to that song, it actually makes me cry because it fills me with love for my father. You know, it takes me back. It makes me very nostalgic. And I, for me, love, like you've just said, you know, it's just everywhere. It's in everything you do. It's in everything you say. So there must be a romantic in there.
Oh, gosh.
You must be romantic to have been married three times.
Yes. Because if you look at it like that.
Yeah.
Yes.
Sometimes people go, right, I've done that once, I'm never doing that again.
Well, Danny was saying about, on, you know, he occasionally on the tour, he'd get me to tell stories about, because it is, it's, and you know, you've got to say that at certain times, it's not, you know, it hasn't all been dead easy, let's face
no,
it.
No, of course.
And at
not.
Certain times, you know, one or other of the children have got very conscious of the fact that there are seven others to deal with, and that, so it's, you know, it is eight children by four different mums.
Yeah,
and
Paul Weller's the same.
Yeah.
You know.
But to my mind, that's that.
You bring it, it's like creating it's, this little family community.
It is. Yeah. It's great.
It's
I mean,
modern.
When it
it's
works, it works.
Of course it does.
And
yeah.
The whole thing is, again, if you're encouraging everyone to really get on and you're doing everything you can to sort of quell instances that are going to threaten that equilibrium.
Yes,
then equilibrium. You know, you're positive, you're accentuating the positive of everything. And here we are then in a situation where all of them have got a big family to look out for them. You know what I mean? All those,
yeah.
All the kids have got lots of other brothers and sisters yeah. around them that are going to make sure they're okay.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, you talk to Miri about this or Ben, or you know, Miles, they feel very strongly, but Dylan, they feel very strongly about this, that they're part of something that's very, you know, they're going to make sure they've got each other's back.
Yeah,
and
it's wonderful.
That's fantastic.
Yeah,
yeah,
I think it is. So what pearls of wisdom then do you, or advice do you give your children? Do you speak of love?
Well, do you know, I don't really, Dylan always says, it's so funny, but I the sort of don't stay up too late kind of comment. Dylan's always found that so hilarious, you know. Oh God, you're being a parent again. You know? And I don't actually. I think one of the things, if you like, it's so easy to have this misinterpreted. But in my opinion, where it comes from is everything comes from your own heart in terms of how much love you generate around yourself. Because if one is comfortable with oneself, then it makes it that much easier to put out to other people good stuff. Mm. Because if you're struggling within yourself, then that, you know, it...
You project without even knowing it.
Without even knowing it. That's... In no way is that bad.
Mm.
But where, if you can find peace in some way, if it is possible to do that.
Mm. I suppose that takes time.
It does. It really, really does. Yeah.
When do you think you felt like that? Which point in your life do you feel that you truly
I think it's
felt
a thing
comfortable
of,
with yourself?
If you can look at yourself in the mirror, put it that way, that's probably a much better way of putting it. If you can, if despite all the things that are going on around you and all the things that are threatening your stability and whatever it is, if in the middle of all of it you can still look at yourself in the mirror and know that you're living your life the right way, I think that's probably, I'm struggling to find that, but probably that's a better way of explaining it.
Yeah.
And that's where I try to go if I possibly can.
Yeah.
You know. And so to me that means that with the kids, I'm just with them. I'm not trying to tell them what to be. We just are together.
Yeah.
And then they can, if I'm comfortable, I can help make them feel comfortable. I mean, one of the people that I see as being a big role model in this respect is Jo Wiley.
She's incredible.
Jo is so empathetic.
She's really incredible.
Yeah, she really is.
Yeah.
I listen
She's
to
a standout
interview.
For me, Jo Wiley.
Yeah. Her interviews, aren't they, Isabel? They're fantastic.
She's got incredible empathy.
She does.
And she's very genuine, and she's, She asks some brilliant questions. I love listening to Jo. Mm. I could never tire of listening to her. So when you said that, you know, she was thrilled that, about your cancer diagnosis, you know, that you were, you'd got the all clear, I could almost imagine her reaction to that.
Yeah.
Because she would genuinely just be so happy, because that's the person that she is. And it comes through in everything that she does, watching her at Glastonbury.
Absolutely.
You know, she's truly engaged with everyone, all ages. Everyone relates to her.
Yeah.
So, you know, she's probably my age. She's in her 50s. Mm. But young people love her.
Yeah.
So she crosses the ages.
She does.
A bit like you, you know. If you come from a good place and you're interested in people, you know, that it doesn't matter who you're with, what age
That's right.
they are.
Or in a way, what's going on in your life, you know. So say, Joe hits this nail brilliantly on the head. And that's not to say that her life is smooth running. It isn't. My life's not smooth running, as we well know. But so long as you're doing your best, that's a bit of a cliche, I know. But what more can you do than do your best? And if you're doing your best and you honestly know that and can see that in your face as you look at yourself and know that you are absolutely doing everything you can.
Being kind.
Yeah, being kind.
Because kindness is probably the one most important thing that we all need to be.
Yeah.
You know, to ourselves and to others. Let's be kind.
Yes.
If we can't be anything else, let's be kind. Because I see kindness as love, really.
Yeah.
So, and it is about being kind to yourself. It's not just about being kind to others.
Absolutely it is. Well, we're clearly, aren't we, very much in harmony on all of this.
And you know that when you meet people.
Yeah, yeah.
So the book, because I was listening to the book, and I obviously have the book with me today because I'd like you to sign it, but I was listening to the Audible on the way down, and I was thinking, oh, I'm going to put Bob on. And it was the first time I'd listened to it. And I thought, oh, God, Bob's not actually narrating his own book, which is just too weird, because you are known for your voice.
I know.
And amongst other things, obviously, but everyone knows your voice. It's your most distinguishing feature. And I thought,
I'm not reading my own book. It's weird, isn't it?
Were you not asked
to?
That's odd.
Mm. And I haven't heard it, so I don't know. I didn't actually want to hear
it. No, I don't think you'd want to listen to your own story.
It's weird, though, isn't it? My book
someone else being... Yeah.
I know.
So have you got another book in you?
I'm not sure, actually, about that, because it's so time-consuming.
Did you like the process?
I loved it. Once I got through the crust into the heart of it, you know, it's... I think any writer, you know, you go through blocks, you go through times when it's not coming easy, and then suddenly you'll go through a time where you're almost losing control of how quickly this is coming out of you. Mm. In fact, I learned when I was writing that when that process began to happen, to just stay with that for absolutely as long as I could. So, you know, if it was beginning to really, really flow, I didn't even want to get up and leave the...
Yeah.
Even
go
and do a quick
loo,
wee. No, let's just keep this going. Because once you break off it, if you're lucky, you can stay in the mindset and go straight back into it, stay in the space.
The energy flow, isn't it?
It's amazing, but it really does come. But I don't personally at all think that I'm a particularly great writer. What I can do is I can write in my own... I can write as if I'm speaking, which actually is something I learned as I was writing to get better at, and also write in some sort of rhythm, so that obviously listening to music all the time, when I was writing, if you imagine the words are sort of going, you know, you know, and there is a rhythm to it. And then I try to make it so that you come to the end of one paragraph and there is a trailer leading from that paragraph to the next. So again, like my radio programs, there's a flow through.
Mm.
So what I learned from program building and from the rhythm of music, that's what I was trying to apply to my writing.
Yeah.
Where, however, you know, I recognize completely my own limitations, or even well demonstrated by, say, my tour with Danny. Because I remember coming off stage one night And Danny had made the audience laugh so much and had been so absolutely brilliant. I mean, I was sitting there in awe of him, just having that audience that night absolutely
funny.
In the palm of his hand.
Yeah.
And he was making them laugh, and I thought he's giving them such a good time. And pretty much every time I spoke, I thought, well, really, all I'm doing is just holding passing the ball back, because I was just loved listening to Danny so much. And we came off stage afterwards, and I said, oh, Danny, I would give anything to have that brilliant wit, that ability that you've got to make an audience laugh. And have such a good time in your company. And he looked at me and he said, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
You know, I said, he said, Bob, I would love to have your gravitas and your, you know, your sort of like that.
Exactly.
And we were at there were two or three gigs on the tour. We did about 24 of them all together. And there were a couple where we were really sticky with the ticket sales. Stoke-on-Trent, Tuesday evening at Stoke-on-Trent, you know, but can he really play and turn it on a Tuesday evening on a sticky pitch in Stoke-on-Trent? Well, we were, we were looking at the ticket sales for Stoke-on-Trent, and it was one of the bigger venues that we'd been booked into. It was about a 2,000 seater or something.
Right, okay, yeah.
So far, as of about an hour before the show, we'd sold 180 tickets. And
did that cover the rent of the place?
Robert Plant was supposed to come and see us that night, or be with us on stage that night.
Could you not announce that?
Thank goodness.
Bang the sales.
Well,
up.
No, that was the thing. We'd arranged with Robert that we wouldn't do that. He just wanted to sort of pop in.
Yeah.
And then about 20 minutes before the show, I get this text from Robert saying, sorry, he won't be coming, too tired. As it happened, it's really a good job that he didn't, because who would want to walk out on stage with that sort of, you know. So Danny and I always had a dressing room right next to each other so we could come and go. And so I wandered into Danny's dressing room. I had my phone, holding my phone, and I walked up to him and I showed him the message, you know. And so he looked at my phone, then looked up at me and went, yeah. I said, oh, well, I mean, come on, Danny. There's 180 tickets gone tonight. I said, I looked at the little screen by the side of the stage to count the audience, you know, and I was literally going, 1, 2, 3, 4,
oh, gosh,
you know, like this.
Is that really? It must be so deflating.
Oh, well, I said, the word I used was, he said, what? I said, don't you think it's a bit dispiriting, like this? He said, what? I said, Danny, there's hardly going to be he says, why are you letting all this bother you? I said, he said, listen, doesn't matter whether there's one person out there, 10, 100, 1,000, we're going to go out there and we're going to make sure they have a great night.
Yeah.
We are going to enjoy it, Bob. You know, it's probably best that Robert didn't turn up tonight. And anyway, we're on a guarantee.
Yeah.
What is there not to
exactly.
like?
Exactly.
And I'm looking at Danny and I'm going, now that you put it like
that. Yeah, exactly. You just got to reframe it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, Danny is good for me.
Yeah.
Because what he would say to me is, don't overthink.
No, absolutely.
Don't overthink, Bob.
Yeah.
Just do it. It's fine.
Because you overthink it and, oh, honestly, it just makes it the whole thing more painful.
Yeah.
You're right. You're going out. You're guaranteed. Just deliver a good show.
Let's do
have
a fantastic
fun.
Show.
Just
enjoy
have fun.
It. Yeah.
I mean, it was a packed house when I came.
Yeah.
And that was a Monday night, or I think,
in
St.
Albans.
Yeah,
most of them were.
But it was fabulous.
Yeah.
And everyone just loved it. And it was a long show. A lot of energy on your part.
Yeah, 72, lots of 72
yeah,
minutes.
Yeah, you know, that's a long show.
Yeah.
I was amazed at your energy. And I was also loving the fact that the audience were totally, totally engaged. But, you know, they're the kind of things, aren't they? When you see that's when our ego gets in the way, because we can kind of go, you know,
absolutely.
It's not
completely.
Us, it's the ego that's talking
going,
oh, God, there's not enough people out there.
But Danny was damn right.
Mm.
I can't remember which venue it was, you know, but we were literally talking about getting older, you know, older rock and roll stars. And I was saying, you know, I feel very lucky because I was brought up in the era of rock and roll, and I can remember hearing them in real time. You know, the new Elvis Presley single, Goddy Holly, Eddie Cochran, Jerry Lee Lewis, Chuck Berry, and all that. Just such an amazing time. And how amazed one was with that that music and that time. Anyway, Danny then is chatting away, and I think to myself, I think I really need to pop off and do a wee. And I'm thinking, how do I explain this? What do I do? Do I suddenly say, excuse me a second, Danny, I've got to just check some music backstage. And then I thought, what am I talking about? So so Danny comes to me, and I said, Danny, on the topic of old, excuse me just a second, I've just got to pop up and do a quick wee. And you should have heard the audience as I walked off. They were laughing.
And then when
I came back on again, they all applauded me as I came and sat down.
See?
And I thought, you see, there's
so you do make the audience laugh.
Nothing to be afraid of.
There isn't. No. There absolutely isn't. When you're writing a book, you're putting it out there, you're sending it out to the world, and you're leaving yourself wide open. Mm. How do you feel in that moment? Does it feel scary?
Well, I'd had some training for this during the 70s, you know, because Whistle Test was the biggest music event of the week in the 70s on television for the 7 years that I was doing it. It was a lot to do with the fact that it was the only thing of its type on TV. Mm. So it became the magnet pull for anybody into their album music. They were watching the Old Grey Whistle Test. So I became obviously the figurehead of that entire feeling, if you like. You know, again, Danny was saying on stage that in those days he'd look out of the window of his high rise, you know, on his estate, and look across the windows of the other bits of the estate, and there'd be blue. You could see there was a blue TV flickering in half a dozen of the rooms. He knew that they were watching the Whistle Test because it had that very cultish thing. And during my first probably three years on the show, it built up from having an audience that was pretty close to almost unregisterable. Although now a figure like 500,000 wouldn't be too bad, but by 1975-6 we were up to 5.5 million a week. And the part of the support of that had come from the press, the Enemy, Sounds, Melody Maker. We were all on the same side. I mean, you know, let's face it, it's music.
Yeah.
What is there not to like?
Yeah.
But when punk came along, it shifted the axis completely. And suddenly this stadium, rock-loving, white, middle-class, middle-aged, long-haired, ex-hippie, you know, BBC TV presenter that had previously represented this great stuff was suddenly representing everything that this new generation didn't like. Mm. And I was an amazing lightning rod for the hate that came with that, not least of which was the way that the press that had been previously 100% behind us literally overnight turned guns back on us and started firing. It was quite extraordinary. And the hate that I had directed at me through two or three years then, was now that was something to have to deal with, because you know,
because you were so much younger then as
well. And you know, there's the Sex Pistols thing at the
speakeasy.
I remember I said this on stage a couple of times, you know, I was walking down West End Lane in West Hampstead, and there was a Route Master bus, traffic was running a bit slow, and there was a Route Master bus sort of riding alongside me as I walked down the pavement, and people were spitting at me from the top of the...
My goodness.
About 5 years ago, when we did the Whistle Test for One Night Only, and we sort of reconvened the programme on BBC Two, and it was Gary Newman, Peter Frampton, Joan Armatrading, you know, it was 3 hours live, and it was so... I loved going back so much. So, we're in the car.
Yeah.
Driving home after the show, and Whistle Test was trending right across social media, and Beth was in the back of the car, excited beyond belief that there she was. She got a phone in her hand. She was reading her name all over because she, you know, she was one of the people on the show. And
yeah.
you know, she's scrolling. She was going, Bob, God, you've got to see it. This is absolutely. This is ooh, you know. And then she started hitting all the hate, and all the people that were throwing loathsome at me. What 40 years previously
had now resurfaced.
So Miles, who was in the car with us, and I think Dylan was, they're going, what is this? They couldn't even believe that music was tribal in the way that it was in those days, because now it's not tribal at all. You know, you either like this track or you know, you're into Dua Lipa, or you may be into Dua Lipa and the Brothers Osborne, and that's what music is like.
Yeah,
that has flow. It comes on her shuffle, and it's anything from Fleetwood Mac to Sam Fender.
Absolutely. My children are exactly the same.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's wonderful, isn't it?
It is. It absolutely is. But it wasn't like that in those days.
No.
And I was the sort of, as it were, the major recipient of that. There was one moment, there was a picture in the original version of my autobiography of a cartoon of me that was done in Melody Maker.
Oh, that's right,
in 1978, with the three pain claws in my shoulder. That was a low point of me just beginning to feel beaten down by this, you know. So nowadays, it's like, again, it's like my dad used to say, you treat those two imposters just the same. Somebody talks you right up, and just stay grounded.
Yeah, somebody, and resilient.
Somebody
just
attacks you,
yeah.
and you're the same.
Yeah.
So those two, what's the quote? Anyway, you treat those two imposters just the same.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so that's what I do now. And so when I see stuff on Instagram, you can't say much more to me than I experienced in 76.
No.
Physically and verbally and everything else. So, you know,
Do you just let it roll off?
Yeah.
So you don't feel the need, because otherwise it's like feeding the lion, isn't it?
The thing
if
is,
you go back.
Yeah, I mean, it's in their head.
Yeah.
Isabel,
it's not
in mine. I don't have anything against them.
But I suppose if you're engaged in such a massive audience, you're going to get that.
Yes,
and
you are.
And learning to be resilient and kind of. And build that kind of wall around yourself and let it go.
The other thing about that is that, you know, my career, if you like, began on the day that I wrote my first article for Unit Magazine in 1967. And my career path opened up to Radio 1 in 1970. And even from there, we're 52 years on. I've been with the BBC for more than half its life. I mean, that's unbelievable.
It is, yeah.
Now, if you look at any career of any long term, that career will have its big ups and downs.
Of course.
You know, you'll be on the top of the world and then. Now, you have to be resilient to deal with the moments when you clearly... I mean, try being me in 1986. I mean, you know, it was a tough call.
Yeah.
And I've had times in my career where I've been really, really struggling. And it's going to happen. You know, it's going to happen. These ebbs and flows.
Yeah.
Not everybody's always going to like you.
No.
I personally am actually quite very sensitive in that respect. So I've had to learn to... I'm a person who possibly, almost to a fault, wants to be liked.
Yeah.
I like being liked. So I'm putting out that signal the whole time. And there are times when that signal is completely rejected or thrown back at me, I find that actually quite confusing.
Yeah.
Because I'm thinking,
What did I do?
Yeah. It's a weird sort of feeling. So, but the one thing I have absolutely learned is that, like on my Instagram, let's say... If I want to start doing provocative stuff, I can just expect it to come right back at me. That's not what I'm about. What I'm about is creating the space of love, if you like, going back to what I was saying, where people are kind to each other. We are looking after each other.
It's a happy place.
There's a sympathy. Yeah,
yeah,
it's a happy
Absolutely.
Place.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that. And we need more of that, actually, I think. We spoke about... your dissection, we spoke about this a lot over lunch, but obviously that near-death experience Because it was a near-death experience that you had. And I mean, you know, like you said, the family around the end of the bed, you don't know whether you're going to survive. Mm-hmm. Because so many people, I don't know what the stats are, Bob, but I know that so many people don't survive.
Yeah.
They don't even get to the hospital in time. Mm-hmm. But how does that, change you? In what way does it change you? I know you've said that now you have this much more, you know, this kind of energy for life. Every day's precious. Mm. Has it changed you in any other ways, do you think?
Well, that people do say it's a cliche that I now hear the birds singing and smell the air and look at the flowers and appreciate everything more than I did before.
Yeah.
But it's true. That is exactly me. I'm appreciating every day now. I mean, I'm really not kidding.
Yeah.
I just feel that I'm blessed to be here and that therefore I've been given an opportunity to be constructive with my life and have people's backs and play great music and be excited and help and be kind and look after my cats and then
simple things. But I mean, a lot of people say that you mentioned, I think you said earlier, that you're not a religious person. Would you say you're spiritual?
Well, I think
seem to me you bit very spiritual. You feel very connected to everything.
You know, I've learned a lot from Beth, I have to say, Beth Nelson Chapman. I first met Beth in the late 90s, but specifically at CMA Awards in 1999. She won with This Kiss with Faith Hill. And we'd met a little bit before. And I didn't realise, I don't think at the time, that she was a real fan of my shows. And anyway, she became my Nashville laminate. She introduced me to everyone. And being with Beth, it was exciting. And I just thought she was fantastic. And then I began to realize that this was Beth. This is her giving. She's a giving person.
Yeah.
She wants to help and she wants to, you know, she wants to be the bridge. She wants to be loving and see you loved. And she has everybody else's interests in her mind and heart. And we really established such a relationship of friendship.
Yeah.
She got breast cancer and I remember doing a telephone interview with her. She would traditionally come into the studio with me and actually play a live session whenever I was in Nashville. Beth always came in, but she couldn't on this occasion because she was in the middle of her chemo. But we had a phone call on, we did the interview on the phone. And Jim Moyer, who was the station manager at the time, was with me in the studio with headphones on listening. And when the interview finished, we took our headphones off and he said, that was so beautiful. Beth is such a lovely person. Because she was fearful but she was grateful that she felt the feeling that the universe was going to look after her. And she was also willing to normalize cancer by just simply talking about it. By just sort of saying, taking all the heat out of it. Oh, it's not, oh my God, there was none of that with Beth. It was, we're dealing with this and we've said that and we're going to, I don't know whether I'm going to be okay, but at the same time, I want to be doing my writing. I want to be doing my living. And I think that the universe in some way will support that. I'm thinking, this woman is just amazing.
Yeah.
And so talking with Beth more and more over the years since then, she's just reinforced all that with me.
Mm.
The cancer, you will overcome it, Bob. It'll be okay. You just got to trust. That's a big word with Beth. Trust.
Yeah.
Trust in the universe.
Yeah.
And I lost that a little bit at one point, about three or four years ago. I was very, very unhappy. And those clouds had begun to obscure the sunlight somehow.
Yeah.
But those clouds have cleared again now. And what Beth has said to me all along just makes so much sense. She is right about the universe. You know this is about, don't you? It does look after you.
It does. Mm. And trust when you're feeling very vulnerable is the hardest thing to do, but that's where the courage is. If it takes a lot of courage to be vulnerable and to trust in that moment, and just hope and let everything just literally hopefully fall into place. Now, you know, we could talk forever about that. And vulnerability, you know, is something that we're raised to bat off, isn't it?
Yes.
But in illness, there's so much vulnerability.
Yes, there is.
You know, you have no idea what the future holds. No. And you've probably experienced that more than most. So, anything you'd still like to do? Is there anything left on your bucket list?
Yes. I want to go to either Australia or West Indies with the Barmy Army.
Barmy Army? Yeah. I love it. Brilliant. Okay, anything that you're really not good at that you would have liked to have been good at?
Well, probably playing cricket.
Oh, really?
I love cricket as a game, and I could just about bat a bit and just keep the ball away out of the stumps. But my dad was a great cricketer, and I grew up with cricket.
Did you?
Around me. Yeah. So
you know Phil Tufnell?
Well, I don't know.
Right, he's an old buddy of mine.
Oh, is he?
Yeah, he's an old drinking partner of mine. I can tell you some stories about him after. Yeah, Tuffers. Yeah. What brings you the most joy aside from music? I think I know that. It's your family, isn't it?
It's my family.
And your cats.
And my cats. Yeah. And being here, frankly, living in this world within a world, which I've managed to establish now. I loved that feeling the moment
I arrived. I loved it. So I love the song Alone Again, which is from the album Forever Changes by Love. Now, is it right that that's your favourite album?
Yes, because John Peel gave me
my final
copy. Yes.
I was going to say, in a world where you're so entrenched with music, is there such a thing as a favourite album? How can that be possible?
Well, that one with sentimental value.
Right, yeah. Okay. Because there's music around you all the time.
Yeah.
And you must have new favourites coming in as well.
I did a lovely session about 2 or 3 weeks ago with Carrie Underwood, who's an absolute country superstar. Mm. And I was saying to her how things have changed since Carrie first started in 2005, when we first got to know her on American Idol. The pace of change in country music has been speeding up ever since. And for me and Mark now on the country show, seeing the number of new names that are coming at us virtually every week, it's quite incredible.
Yeah.
And Carrie said, yeah, it's quite intimidating because now I've got all this competition, whereas we didn't have that brand new competition in quite this volume all those years ago.
Yeah. Favourite Paul McCartney track or favourite Beatles track?
Beatles, Strawberry Fields.
Okay.
Paul McCartney, I'm going to go with Another Day. It the very first single he put out. Or Maybe I'm Amazed, but
oh,
on that,
one. I love on maybe
yeah, Maybe I'm Amazed. I'm going to go with Maybe I'm Amazed because that was his first solo album he
so
played.
Beautiful. All
yeah, and it's such a great
it
song.
It really is. Yeah. Okay, dream car.
Dream car. Mm. Or a Mercedes EQ, the electric version.
Oh gosh, get you!
It's got a screen right across the front of it. Your passenger can have their own screen. It's got tech coming out of its hubcaps.
Amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, dream woman. Who have you met over the years? I mean, who, like, out of all of the women that you met, maybe the superstars, did you mention something about Kate Bush? No. Because I'm sure you and Danny mentioned something in the show about Kate Bush.
Yeah, I mean, may have done. And
she's getting a bit of a revival, isn't she?
She is running up that hill.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. I mean, I remember years ago, we are doing a present company accepted here.
I love that, Bob. Say all the right things.
Jeanne Moreau in a film called Jules-Jim. When I first moved to London in 1966, I was living in Hampstead.
To that in the book.
Is that right?
Yes, just listen to that
funny.
Bit. Jules-Jim, and I was thinking, God, I love a French film.
Yes. Truffaut, wasn't it, I think, was the
director.
Don't
know, but...
There was a cinema up in Hampstead Village called The Everyman.
Everyman.
Yeah.
I go there all the time.
Do you?
Yeah.
And
I'm always
saw
in Hampstead,
there,
I love it.
And I thought Jeanne Moreau was just, wow. I mean, she was she was already, she was, you know, she wasn't a young woman in those days, probably 38, something yeah. that sort of age. She had such a charisma and such a presence about her.
French women do, though, don't they? Is she French?
Yeah, she was.
Yeah, French women have got something about them.
I thought she was.
Yeah,
she was
they're incredibly yeah. sexy. Yeah. Dream place?
Well, not that I've ever been there, but looking on Instagram, how about the Maldives?
Oh, God, I'd love to go to the Maldives.
I mean...
But I think you'd get bored after a while because everyone says there's nothing to do.
I don't
except,
care.
No, I don't think I'd have a problem with it. I'd just read a stack of books.
I'd be in that turquoise
music, exactly.
water. Yeah. Pina colada in my room. Yeah, no, don't worry about
what time would
do.
The pina coladas start? About 11?
The one time I was in Barbados once and we're on a beach where the beach bar, every deck chair had a sort of flag by the side of it. And if you needed... a drink or anything, you'd pick the flag, just put it in the sand, and then somebody would come and bring you a drink. And
oh,
I thought,
goodness.
Yeah, this
that,
is
that, that would
oh
be
God,
lethal.
This is amazing.
I'd start on the pina coladas very early because they feel like breakfast.
They do.
They're just so
they
lovely because they're gorgeous. Yeah. Okay. Well, that answers the cocktail question. Right. Quick food fight.
Okay.
Roast or fish and chips?
Roast.
Toast with Marmite or marmalade?
Marmalade.
Oh, I knew because I saw the marmalade in your kitchen. Mm. Bitter or lager? Well, pale ale.
Well, bitter, but an amber.
Amber. Village Idiot down the road.
Yes.
Yeah. First drink of the day, tea or coffee?
Coffee.
It's got to be coffee, isn't it? Takeaway, Chinese or Indian?
Indian.
Knew you were going to say that because you got the Indian.
Ilachi.
Okay. Brown or white bread?
Brown.
Is that because you're trying to be healthy or is it because you actually prefer?
No, I sort of actually prefer it. So long as it doesn't have the gritty bits
yeah,
in it.
Yeah, too much going yeah. on. Just a nice, simple...
Because I mostly toast, white bread, I don't know, you've got to get exact... Even the toasting white bread's not very nice. Whereas standard wholemeal,
yeah.
is it?
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Just shove that in and
yeah.
it's great.
I know.
It absorbs the butter
with
best.
Butter and marmalade.
Yes.
Butter... Real butter?
Yes, and I absolutely ladle marmalade on it.
I ladle on the butter. Mm. I actually put the butter on, wait for the first lot to melt in,
and then
I put another lot on, and then I put the marmalade on top of that.
So it's then a slightly squidgy.
Yeah.
I cut the crusts off,
yeah,
and then I've got this sort of squidge. yeah.
Right, podcast or book?
Podcast.
It's been
it's
for
both
me.
Of us.
It's
yeah.
been a privilege. It's yeah. been a lovely conversation, and I'm very grateful. I've had a lovely, lovely time. Thank you, Bob.
This has just been lovely. Thank you so much.